Succession, number 30493, reel 14.
What were the methods of killing people that you were instructed in?
Well, it was usually about... you see, that stayed in my memory vividly, that I couldn't tell you... but in my diary, I don't think I go into much... the Cyprus diary, I don't think I go into any detail. As a result, I can't tell you. I mean, we weren't infantry, you see, so we weren't really expected to have, you know, armed conflict. And it was exceptional for a gunner to ever to have to meet physically with an infantryman and a German, an enemy infantryman. So I can't really tell you about actual, you know, lots of evil acts you can do to quickly incapacitate an enemy. You want dead quickly. It was mostly getting you fit and being able to travel over all kinds of rough terrain and obstacles and then come out at the other end in one piece. That went on for 2 weeks. It was interrupted by incredibly heavy rain, and we just were bogged down in mud. And however, that was all part of the training, really.
You were joined to the 10th Indian Division on Cyprus, was?
Yes, we were.
How closely was your regiment integrated?
Now, for me, this has always been an extraordinary aspect of the army, their ability to somehow compartmentalise you. I mean, there we were. We were supporting the infantry. There were, I think, two units of the British infantry. There was the Durham Light Infantry, and I've forgotten the other. But then there were all these Indian units that were part of the 10th Indian Division, and I think I said earlier they really had gone through it. They were a very war experienced division, and of course that's why Churchill had his eye on us, you know. Yeah, as I told you, he wanted to invade Rhodes and paid a special visit and was hoping to persuade the High Command to embark on this, what would have been a disastrous venture, retaking Rhodes. I think the closest we ever got to them, we would see them, the infantry, mark going up to the front, and they would wave at us, and we would wave at them, and they would say, "Hello, Johnny," and we'd call back, "Hello, Johnny." There we are. That's the relation. I've got several photos of Indians on the march. I've got one single photo of an Indian washing himself down. He's got a towel around his middle, and he's got his arms up and soaping his body. And that was the only sort of, you might say, intimate photo I have had of one of our Indian comrades. Now, look at that. I've only just bought this book. Sepoys in the Trenches, the Indian Corps on the Western Front, 1914 to 1915. Now, it's taken all these years to recognise the contribution of Indian regiments in the First World War. It's going to take just as long for somehow... to recognise the contribution of these Indian, what we call there was a label attached to militant. It's supposed to be a particularly militant races that we use to defend the British Empire. But why, you know, because what motivated all those Indians was just bloody poverty. It's a way out of poverty. We can't imagine the abject poverty which most Indians lived, and today still live, although the top 10% have never been so filthy rich. There they were, in that Western Front, cannon fodder for years and years. And here's a book that now pays tribute to those men. It's meticulously researched and well written, a history of a magnificent corps of proud warriors courageously led, to whom this country owes an eternal debt. Now, I've just bought that book because I recognise it's so long overdue.
Did you have much impression of how the Indian troops regarded the British Army and the war as a whole?
Sorry, how?
How the Indian troops in the division regarded
I don't know. How can I put myself in the position of an Indian infantryman? Product of a village, suddenly wants to escape from the poverty of it, and suddenly, you know, sees an advertisement, I suppose, join the British Army, a way out of poverty. I don't know what happens to him. I mean, suddenly, if in fact these people do have a tradition of military prowess, I don't know. I don't know whether it's been invented by the British, you know. They just happen to be tribes or groups of ethnic groups of Indians who have this tradition, but how true it is, I don't know. That's what I'll find out in this book.
Were you much aware of whereabouts in India they had come from?
Well, they were labelled. They would be told that the Punjabis were going. There was a Punjabi patrol going out, and their job was to capture Germans or kill Germans. And I don't know whether I mentioned this. We had to cover that operation, although we just laid smoke for it. And they came out very quickly, successfully. Without casualties, they captured three and killed three. So, you know, that's one of those little repetitious operations that I record in my diary, which were successful, achieved without casualties. We just laid smoke, we didn't find any shells, and it was a sort of a nice sort of humane operation. With just three dead Germans. Well, we chalked those three up. So we knew it was the Punjabi, the Marathas, the Sikhs, the Gurkhas. We knew there were all these Indian ethnic groups were out there, all part of the... again, we weren't well informed about them. I'm waiting for your book to come out and I'll read all about it. most of what I've discovered about the Second World War, and particularly our campaign in Italy, has been acquired from my reading since I was left with a... I wanted to know what had happened. I wanted to know what followed. I followed Italian history very closely. The whole episode of the Red Brigades, the P2 secret fascist organisation, that when that was revealed in the sixties, was it? I think the members of it were members of the Army, Navy, and the Air Force, and the Secret Services, and the police were the leading figures in this semi-fascist organisation that wanted to take over Italy again. I mean, there's literature about it. There's one here. The Puppet Masters, the political use of terrorism in Italy. It's a fantastic book. And most people don't know about it, you see. about that episode. That's all there, documented. It's a bit of absorbing history, and people don't realise how important the history of Italy has been. I discovered, you see, the man who became the paranoid head of the CIA in America was in Italy when I was. Now, that, you see, there's a big fascinating biography out on that man. His name was Jesus Angleton, and he became the top man in the CIA at the height of the Cold War. But his close friend, he'd learned almost everything he knew about espionage, guess who? From Kim Philby in London. He became the best friend of Kim Philby and learned everything he ever knew about espionage and counterintelligence from Kim Philby, who later on he discovers as the top Soviet counterintelligence expert, you know. Don't betray every single bit of information that he ever had to the Soviets. And he was a hero. I would have regarded him as an admirable man in October 1944 in Italy if I'd known about him. But he was posted to Rome as commanding officer of the Special Counterintelligence Unit Z. And in March 1945, he was promoted to first lieutenant and chief of X2 for the whole of Italy. And he was the only non-Briton in Italy cleared to share intelligence from Ultra. Now, that's how trusted he was. And I can give you his office number in Rome, if you like. 22 Via Sicilia. I wouldn't have known that when I was in Rome in 1945. He got the Legion of Merit for catching over 1,000 enemy intelligence agents in Italy. There we are. It took me years and years before I discovered that information. You see, he would have uncovered the agents that were warned about in an article that my friend in Hampstead sent me. Here it is. I've got the clipping from the New Statesman, and she must have sent it to me, 1944, and it says, "How are we liberating Italy?" Now, I would have read that, you see, in 1944. So, in a sense, I would have been, I see Angleton as being part of it now. Now, this article says, "In the 8 months since the surrender, we have tried to reconcile a system of bureaucratic military control with the claim that we had come to free an oppressed and demoralised people. The first-hand accounts that reach us agree that so far the attempt has failed." Now, it sounds like Iraq, doesn't it? Exactly like. I mean, it shows you the people at the top, the generals and the politicians, go on making the same mistakes over and over again. "We've tried to reconcile a system of bureaucratic military control with the claim that we come to free an oppressed and demoralised people." Yeah, now, I read that in 1944. And he says, the writer, whoever it is, says the AMGOT officer, the AMGOT, that's the Allied Military Government of Occupied Territory, the AMGOT officers see in the deposed mayors, which would have been the fascist mayors, like-minded men of property and privilege, who have at least the habit of running things after a corrupt fascist sort of manner. Military expediency prefers them to the nuisance which more democratic but less experienced men might cause. Now, this is the kind of information I was getting, you see, which, you know, which makes the nonsense of this John Ellis's argument, this, that these are sort of generalities that he says are not. It says in under Marshal Badoglio was head of the government then, the Italian government. They deposed Mussolini, who fled to the north, and he writes here that Badoglio has shown no signs of any ability or willingness either to purge the portion of liberated Italy under its control of secret fascist groups. There. So, Eve Angleton out was the man who weeded out these secret fascist groups. So, bloody good luck to him. Although he became totally paranoid and practically destroyed the CIA in the height of the Cold War. It's an extraordinary story. He distrusted everybody, but everybody.
How much were you able to get an impression of what the general Italian population wanted in the post?
Yeah, well, there again, in my war diary, every now and again I meet up with I'm ashamed that I didn't learn Italian better. I should have done. Should have taken the opportunity. But of course, it's not as though we were among Italians. I mean, meeting Italian or being with them was infrequent. So we learned, I think most of us picked up a few words of Italian, and we'd be focused sort of with pidgin Italian. But of course, a lot of Italians had they'd been in the West. I mean, we know that they're again poverty, unemployment, and Italians went all over the world, especially to America, and of course they bought ice cream and pizzas to Britain in the 30s. In fact, there was one guy, talking about nicknames, there was one guy whose name was Grimshaw, but he had a very Italian look, and he automatically became Grimshaw. Groppy, of course, was the ice cream firm in Britain, Groppi's Italian ice cream. Everybody knew about Groppi. So Paul Grimshaw became Groppi because he looked a bit Italian, and he wasn't. Anyway, I've lost my thread of thought. The question.
How much experience you had of?
Yes,
the populations. Aspirations,
yes,
in terms of post-war.
Well, wherever possible, I got talking, of course. And there is an account in my diary, it's totally forgotten now, but there are, it's in my diary, and it describes us living actually in a house. Our gun was literally outside their house. We were sort of, if I remember, a solitary two guns for some reason, detached from the regiment. I'm not sure how much detail there is about that. I've forgotten it. But there it is in my diary. We lived in one room in this badly damaged house, and the family of four lived in there, another room. So we were just with them for several weeks. So we did hear the family story. I'm not sure whether I've already talked about it. And we heard. And then, as I say, it's in my diary now, in detail, how the Germans came up, and they had to flee, live in a railway embankment for 3 months, I think. I came back to the house and found it in a terrible mess. The wine cellar had been hit, and it was ankle deep in their wine. All the animals had been destroyed, and they just had one chicken left. And I talk about the pleasure of being with a family, and there's a beautiful 18-year-old girl there. It was certainly a delight to have around. And elsewhere, well, we on leave, I would talk. I remember talking to a chap who told me his whole history. He'd been in America, in the early part of the century, and sending money home, and he when I've lost the details. He told me whole story. He went back to Italy and at a very bad time because the war broke out and he was left there. I mean, he had to join the fascist army. Anyway, he told me his full story. But that was unusual, you know. We just didn't have much time or the language to really communicate. It was only waving to each other. I mean, in my diary, I describe as towards the end of the war, as we go through one village after another, the whole population turn out, waving and cheering and smiling and handing out wine and whatever they had as a sign of greeting. It's a very great sense of liberating. I haven't got any doubts about this. These moments of euphoria, you know, the sense of liberating the Italians, and. But I do say in my diary, I'm only too well aware that this is going to be followed by disillusion and a disappointment because things are certainly not going to change overnight just because we've turned up. And of course, they didn't change very much, as for the rest of Europe. I mean, people went on being exploited and split into masses of poor people and a handful of rich people everywhere. That's been the pattern ever since, hasn't it?
To what extent did you find regional differences as you moved northwards?
Regional? Oh yes, most definitely. The gulf between southern Italy and northern Italy is just unbelievable. Unbelievable. It's no wonder that the mafia survived so. I mean, these traditions of omerta, the word omerta, silence, that's they were born with it in the South, you know, the idea of betraying them, who's really running things in the South. You know, it's death, instant disappearance. Usually a very horrible end. On the other level, just a day-to-day experience, it was the poverty, how many tiny villages there were, and in inaccessible places. I mean, we were in a position somewhere there, and there was this sort of, I suppose you'd call it a mini mountain, you know? And on top of it were this little village. And one quiet day, I decided to investigate. And I went walking towards this village. And I came across, I sort of caught up with a peasant woman who was walking ahead of me. And she was barefooted. She was in the usual long black garments with a scarf over her head. Walking rather a heavily built woman. I can visualise that today. Isn't that remarkable? It truly is remarkable. But then a sort of remarkable thing happened. Well, I mean, certainly it not happened to me before. She was walking ahead of me. Now, whether she heard me coming up behind her, I don't know. I wasn't far. I was just walking. She must have heard my boots. She was in bare feet. And suddenly she stopped. And she spread her legs. I mean, with her back to me. And she started to pee, you know, heard this piddling sound in front of me. Well, you know, that doesn't happen to everybody, does it? But it was Linda. I don't know whether she did it in order to, you know, sort of a sexual deterrent. I don't know, of course, what. Or she just sort of automatically needed to pee and did it there and then. I mean, it's notorious that peasant women just gave birth in the fields. Or would they go working, you know? I mean, today, when a pregnant woman is so cared for and rushed to hospital and the midwives and all the backup we've got from childbirth, we can hardly believe stories like that, can we? But that is, for centuries, that's the way women gave birth to children. It's horrendous to think about it, isn't it? Anyway, there was, she had a little pittle. I kept walking behind her, and then she took this track up to the village. There's no road. You couldn't even call it a path. This is a track through the boulders and the rocks. And I climbed up behind her and then to this village. They were just hovels, you know. Nobody with shoes. Ragged children. Absolute poverty. Unforgettable, you know, total poverty. People came to their doors and peered out. I've never forgotten that. Never. That's in very south of Italy. Later on, I saw city poverty, of course. Naples, Rome. I saw enough of it there, too. It's not as though the South had a monopoly of poverty and misery under Mussolini. Oh, I do hope it's changed today. Somewhat.
What sort of physical condition were the cities you were passing through in?
Well, my star is full of vivid accounts of the devastation we caused. I mean, the level of shelling and bombing. I've tried to be at home, especially towards the end of the wars, and came up approaching the Po Valley, and the amount of munitions available to us were literally unlimited at that point in the war, 1945. And we had poured through, I mean, 300 rounds, 400 rounds. One of our officers who'd been in the desert fighting said that we had fired more rounds in this particular, on that particular night, than had been fired at El Alamein, the famous battle in the desert in which artillery was used on a massive scale by Montgomery. So it was, the war reached that level of intensity, ferocity. And when we moved forward, we saw the devastation. I've got photographs in my collection of a village that was just devastated. I mean, just heaps of boulders and bricks and some dust. But elsewhere, I describe how immediately the army brings up its bulldozers and starts to neatly stack everything up. And I talk about the startled Italians who've just been bombed to pieces by us. Let's watch their town or village devastated by bombs and shells, and then suddenly in come the bulldozers and tidy everything up. I thought it was a grim joke somehow. And it's true, we were very quick at tidying up, you know, and suddenly a village that was a heap of rubble at least would have a road through it, and what serviceable buildings were used for billets or storage or whatever. Because some places were untouched. It was a miracle, of course. It just meant the Germans didn't halt there. They didn't make it part of their defensive line. But devastation. I mean, no part of Italy escaped, really. I mean, outside Venice, of course, did. It did entirely, but just outside Mestre, where there were rail yards and supply lines, that was absolutely devastated, you know, just a few miles away from Venice. The other city that escaped was Rome. I mean, there again, Rome was bombed. Wherever there were rail yards or supply routes, these got picked out by the RAF or the Americans, and they were bombed. But generally, the centre of Rome was intact. That was very impressive when we got there. Tree-lined roads. It was marvellous. After all the horrors and the devastation, to come into this great city, see the Vatican. I wasn't a bit religious, but to see the Vatican looming over Vatican City in the middle of Rome, well, you know, millions of tourists go there now, but in the middle of a war, that, I don't know,